Support for WERU comes from DeMonte Burleyan Arts, photography and creative services in Maine at burleyanarts.com. That's B-E-R-L-I-A-N arts.com.
The time is 10 o'clock and you are tuned to WERU-FM, 89.9 Blue Hill, 99.9 Bangor, and streaming online everywhere at WERU.org. Maine Arts Alive with your host Michael Donahue is up next.
And welcome one and all to Maine Arts Alive. This is a show that's dedicated to honoring Maine's artists and arts organizations, which just abound throughout this great state of ours. I'm your host, Michael Donahue. Today we have with us a gentleman who has become, to a certain degree, an icon, Stuart Kastenbaum, who is currently, but soon to no longer be, director of the Haystack Mountain School of the Arts. Stuart, welcome to the microphones.
Hi, Michael.
In saying that you are an icon, that's a tribute that I wouldn't make to a lot of folks. You have been the guiding force, along with your staff and all of those who assist you, for what, some 25 years?
Yeah, 26 years.
And now it's time to move on.
Yes, it is.
And what does moving on, what has brought this about? What's this all about, moving on?
Well, Haystack's a remarkable institution, and over the last 5 or 6 years, we've really experienced some, I think, exceptional growth. We established a new program in using digital fabrication, partnering with MIT and the Center for Bits and Atoms, and 3 years ago, we started an open studio residency, which we received a $2 million grant from the Wingate Charitable
Trust. Tremendous grant,
yeah,
yes.
To endow that. So it seemed like we had really expanded our program in a significant way that really was in keeping with our mission but extended it. And I thought, well, it's a good time to move on. Things are great, and I think it's good to leave when things are great and new people can take over the leadership. And so it seemed an appropriate time. And I had a lot of my own creative projects, my own writing that I wanted to do, work with my wife, Susan Webster, in terms of the artwork we do together, and also working with art schools, working with students about how they write and talk about making art, and also getting more involved with the intersection of art and science and the kind of digital technology we've started with MIT. So those are directions I'll be pursuing.
Let's talk a little bit about, I can't imagine there's a whole heck of a lot of people out there that don't know, that don't know Haystack, but let's talk about it as an institution.
Sure.
Here for a while. It started when and for what purpose?
It started in 1950, first year was 1951, it was founded in 1950, in the summer of 51 it started in the town of Montville near Liberty, which is where Haystack Mountain is, and was there for 10 years, and its purpose was to teach craft and craftsmanship, and it was an outgrowth of, an urge after World War II for people to be in touch with things and use their hands. And it started pretty modestly, and Fran Merritt was Haystack's founding director, and Fran, I think, had a great vision for wanting it to take a bigger view of the world. So he early on invited faculty like Annie Albers, the weaver, and Jack Leonard Larson, and I took a bigger view, had international sessions in craft, and so I think always had kind of a larger view of what the potential behind creativity was, and I think I always tried to follow Fran's lead in that.
Now, the school where it now exists has moved, as you say.
Right.
And one of the most fascinating aspects of it is that not just the buildings blend in with the surroundings, but the people blend in with the surroundings, it seems to me.
Right. It's the campus was designed by Edward Larrabee Barnes. It was 1961. It was opened, and I think really was very different for architecture at the time. In fact, if people come to the school now and they ask how old the school is and you say it was built in 1961, they always think it's a much younger building, because I think it's such a fresh idea, the way it's integrated with the landscape, where it goes right down the slope, right to the water, all on posts. And I think it's also an example that the campus was built for about $8 a square foot in 1961, which was inexpensive at the time. But the architecture is remarkable, and that in order for something to be great, it doesn't have to be a big scale. It doesn't have to be expensive. It just got to be the right idea. And I think, to me, the programming at Haystack kind of mirrors that architecture.
Yeah, I was just going to say, boy, that sounds like your philosophy for programming.
Right. So it's a amazing, you know, right now you couldn't afford the property that we're on.
Yeah.
And so everything seemed to happen just at the right time to have built the campus in the 60s, made it possible for the school to be there. Haystack was fortunate to have a founding angel, Mary Beeson Bishop, who provided enough support so that the school was never in debt. So we're able to build the campus. It wasn't lavishly funded. It's always been frugal, but it's always been stable, which means you can act on good impulses because you're not worried about what's going to happen next.
Interesting. I'd like to get back to that thought at some point. I've never taken a course there, but my partner Jane has, and I know many others who have. And have wandered around that campus both when there's things going on and when it was very quiet. And even when there's things going on, there's a peacefulness about it that must contribute to the flow of ideas, the creation of craft.
It is. I think it's a remarkable setting because it takes you away from whatever your daily activity is. And whether you're there for 3 days or a few weeks or 26 years, I think you settle into a way of thinking about what's important, and I think the sense of time about how you work in a studio, you have time to I think go more deeply into the work that you're doing.
Well, it seems to me in this state, and I'd like to hear what you think about this in general in just a moment, because I like to finish this Haystack description, but it seems to me in general trying to make a living as a crafts person in this state, and probably in just about any state, is a difficult process of balancing the need to survive and the need to create. How do you feel that your philosophy and the Haystack aids and abets that process?
I think that we're not a school that's about the business of making, but about the spirit of making. So I think what we do is we are a place where people can come up with ideas. That if you're say you're working in your studio and you're worried about how you're going to make a living,
right?
That may inhibit maybe how you're thinking about what you're going to do because you know you have to make the certain thing you always make.
Yeah.
But if you get away for a while and you say, you know, this is really what I need to make right now, that you can make tremendous leaps in your work in ways that are really unexpected. They're unexpected to me as the person who's been running the program. They're unexpected, I think, sometimes to the person who's doing the making. But you can identify what's important and you're not worried about a market at that point. You're just making. And I think that kind of making really leads to the best work, and the best work ultimately leads to the best reception.
Must be very satisfying for not only the artist, but for you.
It is. It's, everybody who comes to the school, nobody's forced to be there. Nobody's got to take it for credit. Nobody has to take it to complete a course for something. So everybody who's there wants to be there. And in fact, some people may know about the school and they may come, you know, they may have heard about it and went in college and waited years. And then they're, 20 years later, they see a catalog in the studio and they say, this is my time to go.
It's time to go, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that element of its time is kind of necessary for Haystack to work. It could not simply be here, you guys sit here and do this craft because we're telling you to do it.
Right.
It's because they're there because they want.
Everybody wants to be there, right?
Yeah.
And they're ready to work too. So you don't have to do any convincing.
Yeah, a big difference.
Yeah.
In about 20 minutes or so, I'm going to give out some phone numbers, and hopefully those of you listening, if you want to say hello to Stuart or comment, if you're a past graduate or have never heard of it before, certainly welcome to give us a call, and I'll put those numbers out shortly. Okay, can you just quickly go through the various types of crafts that are being worked on
there? Sure. So we have a range of craft media from ceramics to jewelry, textiles, which would be quilt, surface design, weaving, anything to do with textile techniques, basketry, artist books, printmaking, painting and drawing, wood, which could be furniture or sculptural work, blacksmithing, glass blowing. Just thinking if, you know, pretty wide range, anything that really involves working with a material, we do.
Now there's, I was sneaking around your website, which is a very nice website, and it listed some of the various programs that you do, and some of them are self-explanatory, some of them may need some explanation. There's an open studio residency, which I take is pretty much what it says.
Right. That's the new program we started, and it differs from, since its inception, Haystack was always a workshop program. So you'd have a workshop leader and people who are participants who could work freely. It's not like a how-to program. So they could, they would learn techniques, but they'd also be working on their own ideas. But the residency really provides a studio space for artists to work in, and we've tried to expand it so it's people who have background in craft, but also designers. We've invited scientists to be part of it, and writers, choreographers, and they can work in the studios, and they can go into any one of our six studios and also work in our Fab Lab, our digital fabrication studio, and they can move. They're not committed to staying only in one studio or working in only one way, and we have technicians who can help them with their ideas.
What a marvelous.
And then it's also, because we have been able to endow it, it's a free program. So it's...
And then, of course, you have summer workshops
right.
and a conference during the summer.
We have a conference during the summer that I think one thing we've tried to do is to look at craft in a broad context. So what does it? What does craft mean? What does making mean? And so the conference has... evolved into being what we're calling craft thinking, and it's looking at materials and creative process. So how we work with creatively with materials is really at the heart of craft. So we invite people from people who might be using very traditional means to produce craft to people who are working with digital technology as speakers. So we really want to look at things most broadly and see what we have in common.
Okay, I gotta respond to that. What do we mean by crafts? Have you come up with a definition?
Well, I mean, you could say craft is I guess there are a lot of definitions. Craft could be a verb. It's like the how of how you make things.
Yeah.
You know, you use skill and technique to make things.
Yeah.
So you could say craft makes art. You have craft, traditional craft. Practices like pottery or weaving, you know, but within that there's skill and then there's also intent and aesthetics that are part of it. So it's a...
But is it a making of something?
It's a making of something. It's a how you make something. And I think it's characterized by a particular attention to the voice of the material you're working with.
Interesting.
So I think somebody who really understands a material knows it in a certain way. It's the way as somebody, if you fish, you have skills and you understand those in a certain way. And like working with craft materials, you develop skills that allow you to speak with the material and understand what the material's saying to you too.
But by providing an opportunity for cross currents, so to speak, if a potter goes into the metal shop, does that take the pottery in a new direction, or does that take how does that cross pollination work?
Well, sometimes I think you just see how other people are working with a material that's not even yours, and you're inspired by it. Just the way of where you've taken an idea. Sometimes it can give you we're not really have an orthodoxy of craft. Like we don't have a very it's not a. an apprenticeship program where somebody's going to leave and have particular skills. There are programs like that, which are really great. I think ours focuses more on material and creative process. So really that you get to work with the material and you're in a conversation with that material.
I see. just going on with, you have, of course, you have exhibits and so on. You have visiting artists. What is this Fab Lab?
So the Fab Lab is a new building that we put up in 2011, and it's a digital fabrication studio, and it's a partnership with the Center for Bits and Atoms at MIT, which is a program started by Neil Gershenfeld, who is a professor there. And it's taking equipment like a laser cutter, milling machine, a CNC router, electronics, 3D printers and scanners, and using that as a way to complement and augment the studio work that people do.
How does it complement?
So say somebody's working in textiles.
Yeah.
And they can use the laser cutter to help cut out stencils. So they may have a drawing. They could scan the drawing in, and then that could be used that way. You could use it to make equipment that you'd need to make a piece by using any of the equipment. For example, you could make you could do mold making using a CNC router. You could make a mold from an image. You could scan images in. So it gives you a chance to kind of work back and forth.
Is this a new field of craft?
Well, I'd say the digital fabrication is certainly a burgeoning field, and there are maker spaces in a lot of places. The Fab Lab is a particular program that we're affiliated with MIT, and what it does is it gives us access to this entire MIT network.
I see.
And also, to me, it allows us to look at making. It's not like if you're a, like, we're using technology to broadcast on the radio,
yeah,
but we're using,
yeah,
our voices. So, you know, yeah, we're using the most basic thing, which is a human voice, and we're using, yeah, microphones, which is a pretty new technology.
Yeah.
And now they're digital signals. So it's a continuum of how people communicate. And I think similarly with equipment and technology that we use, it's all technology. And so if we say, well, that's new technology, well, you know, my car got me here, that's technology. And everything's technology. So for us, I think it allows us to see this is a continuum of equipment with which people can realize ideas.
Could it take us in strange directions?
Could you, or could it?
Could it, this, could it, this new digital technology. I mean, I don't mean to sound facetious.
Right.
It's just that oftentimes there's the good and the bad. And if we're creating a piece of pottery is now a matter of putting it into a computer and creating a piece of pottery.
It's still a human behind it. So we have some people, one of our teachers from a few years ago, Sana Mamami, who's a potter from Colorado, whose background is Iranian, creates really highly patterned work, glazed work that references that. And she created faceted cups as a digital image, and then she made a 3D model of that. It was printed out.
Uh-huh.
And then she made a mold out of that so she could cast that in ceramics. So it's a casting technique.
Interesting.
And then she does her glazing.
Yeah,
so it just gives you another way.
Just as bringing it
another
around.
Way to do it.
Yeah.
Right. I think the danger with it is any technology, if it becomes a kind of false idol, or you think that that's going to make it possible to do things, you still, I think, always left with the wrestle of how do you say what you need to say? And sometimes you need a pencil to do it, and sometimes you might want to have a 3D printer. It's just knowing what tool to use.
And the interesting conversation in and of itself. The last thing that you do, and according to what I've read, this is very important to Haystack and to you, is keeping the connections with the community. So doing the high school programs and the community programs.
Right. Before I came to the school, Haystack had a program called the Student Craft Institute, which is for students from all around the state, high school juniors generally, who are recommended by their art teachers, and they come for a workshop. So there are 70 kids from almost as many different high schools who come every Memorial Day weekend or late in May and work in the studios. They stay up till 11 o'clock at night. They work on one thing. So that really replicates what adults do when they're there. And then we expanded that to do it for kids from Deer Isle and Blue Hill and now Bucksport and Vinyl Haven are part of that too. And they come for a three-day workshop in the fall. It's called Studio-Based Learning. And then based on that, we added a mentor program where area kids can work in artist studios in the winter. And I think what we want to do is not have programs that aren't as good as our international programs. The programs that we have for high school kids are the same caliber. It's the very same studio experience. So they get to really have a world-class art experience right in their own community. And I think to realize that they're part of a kind of a brotherhood and sisterhood of makers.
Yeah. If being there for the time you've been there, you must have graduates come back and talk about their experiences. Is there any thrust that has, you know, are they suggesting new programs? I'm just wondering where the alumni are going and doing, generally speaking.
You know, I think it comes down or back to this this idea of people coming when it's the right time to be there.
Uh-huh.
So I think sometimes people will come. What I think you hear most is that it allowed them a certain time to realize what they needed to do in their own creative process. Uh-huh. So you might come for a two-week workshop and everything is turned upside down. You think, I don't even know why I'm making anything. And then you start to make something that you've never made before. And then that's going to carry you for 10 years or more. You know, and you come back and you say, you know, if I hadn't come to Haystack, then I don't think I'd be doing what I'm doing. So I think that's a story that I hear pretty regularly. And it's you can't anticipate if that's going to happen. You can't tell people when they get to the school that's going to happen. But I think there's a moment when I think it has to do with the time that you spend at a place like Haystack is a different, there's a different quality to that time.
Yeah.
You're working and there's not an interruption. So if you keep on working, you can get to someplace new.
I suspect there's people who come back year after year.
We have some who come back year after year.
Yeah.
And we endeavor to always make it, I'd say we don't have a tradition that this is exactly what happens at Haystack. The tradition we have is that there's no tradition. We want everything to be a clean slate. As soon as a workshop starts up, it's as if the world's beginning all over again. There's not a curriculum. Yeah. It's the people who are there who make that community, who make that happen.
And I suspect the teachers that you bring in, the faculty that you bring in, how do you make these choices? Is it a matter of, I want to build this program, so I want this person coming here? Or how do you build staff and teachers?
Well, in terms of the staff, we're lucky to have a great staff and people who've been there for many years, many of whom are makers. So they already bring a great sensibility that it's an artist-centered place. When you have people who understand that creative process, actually fixing things, then they're really there with you, and that's really important. And then the people who come to teach, generally every year it's a whole new faculty. Now, some of them return, you know, periodically, maybe every 5 years, 4 years, but half of the people teaching for the summer of 2015 have never taught at Haystack before, and the other ones have taught, but not, you know, probably 3 or 4 or 5, 6 years ago, or even longer. And we try to have a balance between the different ways people are using the media. There's a Haystack's board, is the majority of people on the board are artists, and they also recommend people to teach. So when I'm putting the schedule together, I'm looking at all the try to find out what the trends are in craft, try to bring in people who are unexpected and have people from different backgrounds, people from other countries as well. They have visiting artists. This year we're having Richard Blanco, who is the inaugural poet at President Obama's second inauguration, and Myra Kalman, who writes and draws frequently in The New Yorker, are going to be visiting artists. So we want to bring in people from, you know, outside our field too.
So what kind of journey is this for the teachers?
I think it's as exciting for the teachers as it is for the students to have a group of students who are ready to make a big leap every day and every moment.
Drinking it in.
I think it's thrilling, and I think teachers look at their experience there and think, this is how teaching should be, then is the kind of purity to it, because there's not, you're not going to get a degree out of it. You're just there for that moment. And I think so there's a kind of synergy between the teachers, the students, the place.
The conversation we've been having has been primarily around Haystack. You are so synonymous to Haystack. I want to go into the process of leadership, what it's been like for you leading this organization in specific. But you were talking about tradition just now. And you made a comment. There was a wonderful article in October in the Packet. Telvin Schuetz, I think I'm pronouncing the gentleman's or woman's, the author's name. There's some wonderful comments in here that you made. I'm going to steal some of them to ask you some questions. You stated that the delicate balance that exists between maintaining tradition while introducing enough change to stay innovative requires a great degree of care, this constant balance. And describe that.
I really said that, huh?
Yeah, you have to live up to it. Yeah, sorry, Stuart.
Well, I think you want to understand where a place has come from, what its mission is, but you also don't want to say, well, it can only be this thing. You have to say, what does it need to be now? So I think it's just like an institution's like a work of art in a way. You know, it has to – you have to see possibility in it and be open to what it can be. So I think we want to honor the way of working the craft is. And some places, you know, there are some art schools and institutions that go more towards art and have taken craft out of their name.
Yeah.
Like the Museum of Arts and Design was the American Craft Museum, and
yeah,
they changed their name. And California College of Art and Craft is now just California College of the Arts, because they felt the craft was confusing. To us, I think, you know, we're just saying this is what we do. We make things. We use materials to make things. And then we've been as innovative as we can be within that context. So we're it kind of turns everything on its head in a way too. We want to surprise people.
Each year you sit down at some point and you say, okay, where are we going next year? What have we had? What has happened this year? How does that dictate what's going to happen next year? You sit down and you go through that process of making decisions about who you're going to invite in, new programs, things of that nature. What is the thread that goes through all of that that helps you, guide you in making these decisions?
Well, I think that there are programs that when you hear about them, you say, ah, that is a great idea. It just has a rightness to it is one thing we're looking for. I think that it's related to materials and creative process in some way, and that it's about really – we're really a place that's focused on creativity and potential.
And it's also helping to define the institution in new ways each year, is it not?
I guess it is. You know, this year we began a program with veterans, a group called Combat Paper.
Ah.
And they I'd met Dave Keefe, who runs the program in New Jersey. It's called Combat Paper in New Jersey. He just came to visit 3 years ago, just wanted to see the school, and we had lunch together. And then I thought, well, it seems like a really interesting group. They make paper out of their uniforms. It's a veteran-run organization. They cut the uniforms up, beat the uniforms into a pulp, make paper, then make images that relate to their service. And they also have writing, and they may use the paper for writing as well. And I invited them to give a presentation and show people what they did. And they did that 2 years ago. And it seemed like a moment where it seemed like it's important for us to be involved with veterans. Here's a great way that we could help work with them. And we're fortunate to have our own facility so that you don't have to run through a lot of processes. It's fortunate to have a small scale so you can say, well, let's give it a try. And we invited Combat Paper back. We got a grant for to give two fellowships to veterans to take our workshops. And then Combat Paper ran a one-week workshop where veterans could come and work together. And based on that, we realized we'd like it if the veterans who were – it was a drop-in program, if they could stay at the campus. So now we've expanded the program so they'll be able to stay at the campus in May and work on projects. But it's an example where it's really comes with human contact, meeting somebody who's doing something exciting and it seems like it would be a good fit with what we do, and then continuing to follow that and look for opportunities for funding and other support for it.
This is, again, maybe I don't want to make too much of it, but it does seem to be self-defining each year in a certain way. And this could work against tradition, but how would you put in words what the tradition of a haystack is?
The tradition is that it's based in materials and creative process, that we bring together a community of makers, and a community is really an essential component.
So that factors in everything, all the decisions you make.
Hugely, yeah. But we also want to bring together not just that it's like a small community, but that you're bringing together the remarkable thing that happens at Haystack is that you can bring together, you know, somebody in their 90s from Maine, somebody in their 50s from Ghana, and you can bring together along with an 18-year-old from Florida, and somebody's in a master's program, and they all come together, and for the period of time they're together, they find a way to communicate.
Yeah.
And so you get a kind of an integrated, non-hierarchical community, and I think not having a hierarchy is really a critical part too. So you may have people who know a lot more than other people, but we all eat our meals together, we're all talking about ideas and making, and there's not a star system. Everybody's in there together.
Yeah. I want to take a moment just to do a break here and let everybody who's listening that we're talking with Stuart Kastenbaum, who is the current director of Haystack Mountain School of Crafts, who will soon be leaving for other fields, other pursuits. And I just wanted an opportunity to sit and talk with him. This is WERU Community Radio. We are 89.9 in Blue Hill and 99.9 in Bangor. And I said a little while ago that I'd throw some phone numbers out, so let's do it. I encourage those of you who have been listening to talk with Stuart, join in the conversation here, especially those of you who have taken courses there. I'd really love to hear your reaction to that experience. There's two numbers, 469-0500. Again, that's 469-0500. For those of you who love 800 numbers, and I know there's many of you out there, 1-866-625-9378. So, back to the conversation on WERU Community Radio. Stuart, you used the word hierarchical. yet the buck stops with you. I mean, isn't that, in a sense, you're the one who's moving all of these various people through a summer or through a conference or whatever?
Well, yeah, along with the staff who are working there.
Yeah.
Well, there's a structure, I'd say, but the structure doesn't we want what happens in the studios really to be the most central thing in the creative process. So I think every decision we make is really based on honoring that. So there's leadership.
Yes.
And there's somebody like, you know, I would be saying, well, you can do that, you can't do that, or will you give us money and all those things.
Well, there's of course, the fundraising aspect and so on. But
I think at its essence, and I think what makes Haystack really characterizes it as an institution is that it's a small scale with big ideas, but it's a relatively small community. There are only 85 people at a time that can be there. and that everybody helps everybody else out. So if you know if you need help carrying something, somebody's going to help you carry it. If you need a hand with an idea or conversation, somebody will be there. So I think, you know, that that's what I mean about the there's not a hierarchy, but there is a. I mean, there is like a leadership structure. It's not like, well, whatever you want to do is okay.
Right.
We want to shape it, but we want within that to be open.
I think what I'm getting at, and was not trying to be indirect, what kind of leader are you?
I don't know.
I'd
say I hope I would be able to listen to people's ideas, understand what they're saying, and then try to shape those into a vision and move that forward. So we have a planning process. We're looking at things like our involvement with MIT really grew out of a process with the board of directors. It was in I said, well, I want to be able to convene more people from different areas. And some people on the board suggested digital technology would be a good field. And then I set about working on having a conference and approached some people I knew at MIT. And that took probably 2 or 3 years. And that was in 2002. And then based on that, we met a lot of people in the digital field could move from there. But so it kind of, I'd say, but I wouldn't have gotten there if other people hadn't had the idea first. And I think so it's really trying to listen to a lot of ideas and see what makes sense for what we can accomplish as an institution too.
What would you say are some of the learnings that have come your way over the years of being director for Haystack? Learnings about leadership, learnings about nonprofits, learnings about the arts, crafts.
I think, you know, probably the one thing is that people give to ideas and they want to support things that excite them about what you're doing. So that if you have the best programming makes for the best institution, and if you can make the very best programming you have, people will see why it's important to support it, and then that allows you to grow, and you're not in a position where you're struggling because you can't get funding. I mean, it's always a struggle to get funding.
Always.
You always have to work on that, but if you have ideas that excite people, it's much easier to get that support because people want to be part of an idea that's going to that has a rightness to it.
Yeah, it's time, so to speak. Yeah, again, you mentioned in that article that you love creating programs, finding new programs.
Yeah.
Is that where you're headed, is to find new programs for yourself, or where are you headed next?
Right. Yeah, well, I think I may have a tendency to just, if I see something I want to try, that I'll look for opportunities to make that happen. And right now, one area that has been interesting to me is since I've seen probably 2,000, 2,500 presentations by makers over the years, that I have a sense of like what makes a compelling story, how people can speak about their work. And so this winter and spring, I'm going to be doing some workshops at art schools, working with students on how they write about their work, how they speak about their work, so that they can actually tell their story, tell the essence of what they do in a way that's compelling.
There seems to be. You're getting to the point of saying that communication, an artist needs to talk about, communicate what's going on in their soul, in their self, in their creative process.
Well, I don't think they have to, but if they want to, I think they should be able to do it in a way that they conveys what they mean. But if they don't want to say anything, they don't need to.
And your next steps, where you're headed, is to try and develop programs that offer this opportunity to express oneself.
That's one thing. Another thing is I'm really excited about, in the work that we've done with MIT, you have people who are working with their scientists and artists coming together. And to me, they're both creative processes, or because you don't know what you don't know the answer you're going to get in either one. If you do, then you're not really investigating. And to work with those groups in some ways together to bring together teams to work on ideas, I think is a really exciting direction. Then the third thing I want to do is just as a writer and a poet, a lot of my creative impulses go into actually directing. And so I just want to have more time for my own writing as well.
You are, as you say, a poet. And you and your wife kind of work together sometimes in how you put forward what you've created.
Right. Yes, Susan does imagery, and then I do text with the images. So we've worked together.
And you see that process maturating or continuing.
Definitely would give us more time to work together on projects.
There's a process that happens when someone, especially someone such as yourself, who has become a strong leader, has become identified with an institution and decides to move on. There is a process that happens, and it has both positive and negative aspects to it. You stated that you don't want to hover over that process. And I see we have a phone call, so I'm going to hold to your answer to that. But caller, if you would give us your first name and where you're calling from.
Is that all right? My name is Connie, and I'm from Frankfort.
Great. What's your question? What's your comment?
Well, I just had a comment. 2 years ago, I was going to be retiring from my job, and I wanted to do something special. So I signed up to go to Haystack, and initially I didn't get in, and I was on the waiting list, but I just popped in at the last minute and was able to go. But I just wanted to say how thankful that I was that I could go, and that what was really most important or an important thing for me was the gift of time, because I had worked on my art an hour here, an hour there, but not for days. And it was really interesting to see how you could get in the habit of using so much time during a day and then be excited to come back for the next day. And after even 1 week, to come back for the second week and still keep working. And if you weren't in a place where that was what you were doing, and there wasn't a lot of other distractions other than the beautiful scenery, it's hard to get that much time. So I'm just thankful to Stuart and all his work there that allows people to really have some time to put in on their art. It's just a thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Well, before you go, question. Are you still there?
Yes.
How has this manifested itself over time? Has this changed the way you approach your work, or how has that lasted?
Well, I was there not last summer, but the summer before. But I last winter would have had a lot of free time, but I was able to really start working on my art and put in some more serious time at home. I mean, my circumstances had changed. I wasn't going to work every day, but I still appreciated the discipline of knowing that I could work for that many hours or many hours, as many as I wanted to, and it would still be interesting. And also that I could keep a kind of a few projects going, not just working on one all the time, but just having two or three, and I could just work on one for a while and switch to a different one.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for calling, and appreciate it.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Any thoughts about what she had to say, that issue of time? We've talked about it, but it's I never realized how important that was.
Yeah, I think it's really it's so central. I think it's we had with some of the high school kids that we've had, we asked them to fill out evaluations as we do with all our programs. And one year, one the kids wrote, because you realize in school they go like 45 minutes, maybe an hour would be a long period, hour and a half if – but still a lot of in-between stuff. Yeah. And this kid wrote, and we said, how's it different from school? And she said, well, if you mess up, you can start over again. And in school, you can't.
Interesting.
And I thought, you know, if you think about all those things, if you had extra time to work, you have a mistake, which is going to happen to everybody, or it doesn't work out, well, then the next iteration is the important one. And if you're in a
place where learning process.
You're in a place where the bell rings, you've just made a mistake. You haven't seen where that mistake could lead.
It could really cut into what happens next, as you say.
It could happen to scientists, too. Yeah.
Well, I would imagine all of us one way or another. Again, the phone numbers, if you'd like to call, is 469-0500 or 800-1866-625-9378 here with Stuart Kestenbaum. Stuart, before the caller, I was going on and on with an exceptionally long question, but let's see if I can make it a little shorter. When change happens in an organization, leadership change happens in an organization, it's a positive and negative time. It's a time for a kind of rebirth, but it's also a time to say, well, what we've had, we always want, rather than looking for new. And you're saying you don't want to hover but over that process, but at the same time, you probably are going to have input in that process, are you not?
Well, I'm trying not to have much input. I think it's really important for me to step away. And, you know, if I'm asked for advice, I'm happy to offer it. And when the new person's hired, you know, we'll give as much advice as is needed or wanted, rather. But I think, you know, people do best when they're just working on their own and they don't need somebody saying, well, it used to be this way, it used to be that way,
right,
because that's what used to be. And I think you really need, for a vital institution, that it needs to be true to its mission. But there's a lot of latitude in how you interpret that, and it's important to bring in, you know, new leaders who can take organizations in different directions.
You've said a couple of times during our conversation that Haystack needs to be what it is now, but there's future inside that statement, and that delicate balance that we've talked about between what it is and what it needs to be. How does this your leadership style has impacted that?
Well, when I first came to Haystack, I was a student. I took a ceramics workshop in 1970s, and sometimes I'll look at what's going on at the school. You know, the campus, the architecture. We've really remain true to the spirit of the architecture. So if you were there in the 1960s or 70s or 80s, and it would look the same to you in a way. And there's something about the constancy of it is really, I can look around when everybody's in the dining room and it feels like when I was first there. And I realized people have changed, the way they work has changed, technology has changed, but the sense of community is really the constant community that's dedicated to creativity and making. And to me, that's the part that has traveled through time with us. And as long as we're true to that and honor that, then everything will be okay.
And that's important.
I think that's essential.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The 10 years from now, when somebody's wandering through a Haystack and they say, oh, I remember Stuart Kestenbaum. He was the director here. What would you like people to remember about your tenure as director of this Haystack?
I don't know. You'd have to ask somebody else, I guess. That I could juggle.
Can you elaborate on that? I think that's an interesting answer.
I can juggle, physically juggle, and I think administration's not too far from that. You have to be able to keep more than one ball or two balls in the air at the same time. You have to be able to anticipate what's going on. So I think maybe what I'd want people to remember is that I honored the traditions or non-traditions, as it were, that Fran Merritt had started to really be an institution that led in terms of how people look at making and creativity, and I had carried that forward and allowed the institution to be what it needed to be.
If all goes well and your future turns out to be what you want it to be at this point, how would you describe that future?
Oh, I'd write a beautiful poem every day.
And work with your wife.
Yeah, we'd make artwork together, and then that would be great. That would be a beautiful day for me.
Well, without a doubt, Stuart, the institution which is Haystack has benefited from your leadership. And I think, obviously, within the confines of this particular institution, there is particular leadership required. And it's in what you're telling me is it's a matter of listening and responding, but responding in a way that is true to what the organization is all about. Am I correct in that?
I think that says it.
And in a sense, Haystack kind of lends itself to that kind of leadership.
Well, it's great because you can make it's a scale that you can make changes pretty easily. I used to work at the Maine Arts Commission before I was at Haystack, and when we did our digital fabrication program, it took us from start to finish at Haystack, you know, from when we saw the opportunity to building the building and getting the equipment was about a year.
Huh.
And if I were in state government, I'd probably still be working on that project. and so I think that it's, you know, there's not a lot of layers to get through really. Yeah. It makes it a, you know, I can't. I want to do other work in other places, but I can't envision ever working at another place because it's the perfect scale and to work.
When will you actually be leaving?
The end of May.
Okay. Is there going to be any a party going on?
Nobody's told me.
I hope there's something going on and you get a chance to whack away at the horse and whatever. Stuart, thank you so much for being here today. It's an honor for us to have you here.
Well, thank you, Michael. I really appreciate it. Thanks so much for having me.
The course of events of Haystack will be something that we'll follow and hopefully someday bring on a new director and hear what he or she has to say about the future. So again, thank you. I have some announcements that need to be made here at the end of the program, one of which is that there is a, on December 6th, there is a WERU live and local radio auction is going to be going on, and you can learn more about this on the WERU website. But there's going to be some 70 items. And interestingly enough, Haystack is part of the auction item that some studio programs and so on. The Acadia School traditional music, Waterfront concerts in Bangor. Oh, I got several sheets here. Waterville Opera House and the Stonington Opera House, the Strand Theater, Penobscot Museum, Marine Museum. All these folks. I've gotten together and basically said, gee, you know, ERU is worth supporting. Here's one way we can do it. And what it means for you out there listening is that you get some great deals. So put right now, whatever you're doing, drop it and get your calendar out and put down Saturday, December 6th from 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. is the WERU live and local auction. That's the word I want. I also wanted to mention that we have access through the WERU webpage and also on its own, a webpage for Maine Arts Alive. And on it are announcements about upcoming programs and also an opportunity if you want to leave a comment. If those of you that caught the program with Stuart a little too late or were humbled by the thought of a phone call, go to the website and leave a comment, and I'll make sure that Stuart gets to hear about that. So you can go on, as I say, to WERU website and just go to a place where it connects to Maine Arts Alive. And the program for next month, December, is rather interesting. This is the first opportunity of, I don't know what we're going to call it. It's our acting troupe. And we have a concert theater presentation of A Christmas Carol. And it stars local artists and myself, and is going to hopefully be a traditional Christmas carol every December. So listen in, and if you like it, let us know. If you think that we are the worst bunch of actors you've ever heard, let us know that too, and we'll make sure that we do it right next time. In January, we're going to be having our annual roundup, Maine Arts Commission and others talking about where the arts have been over the last year, arts and crafts, and where they're headed in the future. So that's a load of stuff that I wanted everyone to know about. And Stuart, you've been very patient sitting here through all of that, but one last thank you. And I'm going to sign off and allow the music to run a little longer than it might normally. This music was composed by Walter Gaffney Kessel, and I wanted you to hear it. And my engineer has been Amy Brown today, who I thank always for all her great work. Take care.